The object is to fence, according to the Amateur League's official code of rules.
And that's how you've taught Dr. Gibson to fight, Ransom said.
Oui!
For what? Ransom asked with blistering sarcasm. To take part in a spontaneous fencing match that's going to break out in some East End slum? She didn't come here to learn how to fight gentlemen, Beaujart. She needs to know how to defend herself against men like me. Removing his mask, Ransom cleared away the locks of hair that hung in front of his eyes with a quick shake of his head, the short, dark layers seeming to come alive before settling into place. He skewered the maître d'armes with a hard stare. Dr. Gibson has no idea what to do if someone disarms her in the middle of those pretty moulinette cane twirls you've taught her. You've lived in Paris. You must know some savant, or at least chausson. Why haven't you shown her any of that?
Because it's not correct,
Beaujart retorted, ripping off his own mask to reveal a narrow, flushed face and black eyes slitted with fury. Correct for what? For a moment, Ransom looked genuinely bewildered. Monsieur Beaujart gave him a scornful glance.
Only a peasant thinks the purpose of fencing is to stick someone with the pointy end of a sword. It's a discipline. It's visual poetry with rules.
God help me, Ransom said, staring at him incredulously. Garrett decided it was time for diplomacy.
Mr. Ransom, there's no need to berate Monsieur Beaujart. He's instructed me to the best of his ability.
Have you? Ransom asked the maître d'armes, his voice soft and savage. Or have you given her lessons suited for a lady's parlour exercise? Teach your other students how to be picturesque, but teach this one how to fight for her life. Because one day she might be doing just that, armed only with the skills she's learned from you. He gave the other man a withering glance. I suppose that when she's lying on the street with her throat slit, at least she'll be able to console herself that she didn't score any illegal points. A long, long silence passed, while Beaujart's vehement breathing slowed. His rage faded into an expression that Garrett had never seen from him before.
I understand, he eventually said with difficulty. I will make the necessary adjustment to her training.
You'll include some savate? Ransom pressed.
I'll bring in a special tutor if necessary.
The men exchanged bows, and Garrett curtsied to her fencing master. It troubled her that Monsieur Beaujart wasn't quite able to meet her gaze. He departed with great dignity, closing the door behind him. Left alone with Ethan Ransom, Garrett watched as he went to set the fencing foil and his other gear in the corner. "You were rather hard on poor Monsieur Beaujart," she said gently.
"Not hard enough,"
Ransom said, switching to his Irish accent. "I should have spent 15 minutes painting hell to him." He unstrapped the plastron and dropped it to the floor.
"You've more of a practical need for self-defence than any student here. His arrogance or laziness has put you at risk."
"I don't know if I should feel more insulted for Monsieur Beauchard's sake or my own," Garrett said dryly.
"I didn't insult you."
Ransom stripped off his gloves and tossed them aside. "You imply that I'm incompetent." Ransom turned to face her.
"No, I've seen you fight. You're an opponent to be reckoned with."
"Thank you," Garrett said, somewhat mollified. "For that, I'll overlook your remark about my moulinette twirls." She saw the flash of an elusive grin.
"A waste of motion they are," he murmured, "but very pleasing to the eye."
Garrett realized this was the first time she'd ever seen him in good lighting. The stunning brightness of his eyes, blue from across the room, sparked an unfamiliar but pleasant tingling high up under her ribs, like delicately tightened knots. His features were ruggedly masculine, with that strong nose and geometric jaw, but the long sweeps of black lashes were a luxurious touch of softness, and when he'd smiled, she could have sworn there was a hint of a dimple in one cheek. Ransom began to meander along a wall of framed illustrations of fencing positions, viewing them with feigned interest. Garrett was more than a little charmed by the hint of boyishness, as if he weren't quite certain how to approach her. He cut a splendid figure in the fencing uniform, a head-to-toe scheme of all-white that usually did the male form no favours. The canvas jacket, buttoned on one side and closely fitted down to the high hip, tended to make the average man's shoulders appear narrow and the waist look thick. The snug, flat-fronted trousers would highlight even the slightest tummy bulge. But on Ransom, the severely tailored garments only served to emphasize a physique of remarkable proportions. His body was lean, lithe, powerful, with no trace of softness anywhere. Garrett's gaze travelled from the broad shoulders down to the slim hips, and then even lower to his thickly muscled thighs. As it occurred to her that she was staring, she glanced upward and blushed like a schoolgirl as she met his questioning gaze. "I was just noting the unusual development of your quadriceps extensis," she said in her professional voice. His lips twitched.
"Are you paying me a compliment, doctor?"
"Certainly not. It was merely an observation. Your physical build might lead one to assume you were a sailor or a blacksmith."
"I've done a bit of forging and pressing," Ransom said, "but only light metalwork. Nothing so difficult as what a blacksmith does."
"What kind of metalwork?" He straightened one of the frames on the wall.
"Locks and keys, mostly. I apprenticed for a prison locksmith as a boy."
Without looking at her, he added,
"My father was a turnkey at Clerkenwell."
Most prisons, including Clerkenwell, were unsanitary, hazardous, and crowded, as if it was believed they should have a deterrent atmosphere. In her opinion, no boy should have been allowed to work under such conditions. "A dangerous place for a child," she commented. His shoulders hitched in a shrug.
"It was safe enough, as long as I heeded the rules."
"Did you have brothers or sisters?" she asked.
"No, I was an only child."
"So was I." Although Garrett rarely volunteered personal information, she found herself continuing. "I always wanted a sister. My mother died when I was born, and my father never remarried."
"He was a constable in E Division, eh?"
Garrett looked up at him quickly. "Yes, how did you know that?"
"I read it in the newspaper."
"Oh, of course." She made a little face. "Reporters insist on portraying me as a curiosity, rather like a talking horse."
"You're an unusual woman."
"Not really. Many thousands of women have the minds and temperament to practice medicine. However, no medical school here will admit a female, which is why I had to study and train in France. I was fortunate to become certified before the British Medical Association closed the loopholes to prevent other women from doing the same."
"What did your father say about it?"
"At first, he was against the idea. He thought it indecent for a woman to have such an occupation, viewing unclothed people and so forth. However, as I pointed out to him, if we're made in God's image, there can be nothing wrong with the study of the human body."
"And that changed his mind?"
"Not entirely. But when he saw the opposition I faced from friends and relations, it put him on his mettle. He can't bear anyone telling me what I can't do, and so he decided to support me." Amusement tugged at Ransom's lips as he came to stand beside her. A shadow of whiskier grain was visible beneath the close-shaven skin. His complexion was clear and fair, a striking contrast to his rich dark hair. Slowly he reached out to take the cane from her.
"We won't need this for now."
Garrett nodded, while a pulse tapped in her wrists, throat, the backs of her knees. "Shall I remove my gloves?" she asked, trying to sound businesslike.
"If you like."
Ransom set the cane on the floor along the wall and turned toward her.
"This will be easy for you," he said gently. "You might even enjoy it. In a few minutes, I'll let you throw me to the floor."
That startled a laugh from her. "You're twice my size. How could I do that?"
"I'll show you. But first, we'll start with something simple."
He waited until she tossed her gloves aside.
"Do you remember what I said about the most common way women are attacked?"
"They're choked from the front."
"Aye. Usually against a wall."
Carefully he took Garrett's shoulders and guided her backward until she felt her shoulder blades touch the hard surface. His big hands lifted to her throat, the fingers strong enough to bend copper coins. A frisson of alarm chased down her spine, and she stiffened. Ransom let go instantly, his brows drawing together with concern. "No," Garrett assured him hastily. I'm perfectly all right. It's just that I've never had someone take me by the throat before." His voice was soft.
"You've nothing to fear from me. Ever."
"Of course." She paused before adding wryly,
although when I mentioned you to my father, he warned that you were dangerous.
I can be.
Garrett gave him a superior glance. Every man likes to think there's a part of his nature that remains untamed and unsubdued.
You know all about men, do you?
He asked, with an edge of mockery. Mr. Ransom, the male sex has ceased to be a mystery ever since my first course in practical anatomy, which included the dissection of a cadaver. That should have set him in his place, but instead he laughed quietly.
I've no doubt you can carve up a man like a jugged hare, Doctor. That doesn't mean you understand the first thing about him.
Garrett regarded him coolly. You think me naive?
Ransom shook his head. I see no fault in you, he said, with a quiet sincerity that threw her off guard.
His fingers, dry and warm, returned to her neck with the lightest possible pressure. She felt the texture of a callus on his forefinger, like the rasp of a kitten's tongue. The contrast between the brutal strength of his hands and the incredible gentleness of his touch caused gooseflesh to rise everywhere.
"Now then," Ransom murmured,
his thick lashes lowering as he focused on the tender front of her throat where his thumbs rested.
"In this situation, you have only a few seconds to react after he takes hold."
"Yes," Garrett said, aware that he could feel her breath and pulse and the movements of her swallowing. The pressure on the trachea and carotid arteries would cause unconsciousness very quickly. Tentatively, her hands came up to grip his elbows. "If I pulled down on his arms like this..."
"Not if he was my size. You couldn't budge him. Tuck your chin down to protect your throat, and put your palms together as if you're praying. Push them up through the circle of my arms. Good. Higher. Until it forces my elbows to bend. Can you feel how that loosens my grip?"
"Yes," she said, in pleased discovery.
"Now grab my head."
Disconcerted, Garrett gave him a blank look.
"Go on,"
he encouraged. To her embarrassed annoyance, a nervous giggle escaped her.
She never giggled.
Clearing her throat, she made herself reach out and shape her fingers over his skull until the heels of her hand rested against the neat outer curves of his ears. The short cropped locks of his hair were like coarse silk.
"Take hold closer to my face," Ransom said, "so you can push your thumbs into the eye sockets."
Garrett winced.
"You want me to gouge a man's eyes out? I show the bastard no mercy, as he'll show none to you."
She adjusted her grip tentatively, resting the pads of her thumbs not directly on his eyes, but at the outer corners where the skin was fine and hot. It was difficult to meet his gaze. The colour of his eyes was so intense that she had the sensation of being pulled into blueness, almost drowning in it.
"As you apply pressure to the eyes," he continued, "you'll be able to push the head back easily. Then jerk it down until the nose hits your forehead."
Before she moved, he cautioned,
"Slowly. I've had my nose broken before, and it's not an experience I'm after repeating."
"How did it happen?" she asked, envisioning some life-threatening situation. "Were you quelling a riot? Stopping a robbery?"
"I tripped over a bucket," he said wryly, "in front of two constables, and a reception cell filled with a half-dozen prisoners on remand, a deserter from the army, and a man in default of bail."
"Poor lad," Garrett said sympathetically, although she was unable to hold back a chuckle.
"It was worth it," he said. "A fight was brewing among the prisoners, but they all started laughing so hard they forgot about it."
Abruptly he turned businesslike.
"In a real situation, pull your opponent's head toward you with as much force as you can. Bash him as many times as it takes to make him let go."
"Won't I knock myself unconscious?"
"No, this is too hard for that."
Ransom paused to tap a knuckle gently against her forehead, as if knocking on a door panel.
"It will hurt him far worse than you."
His hand returned to her neck, fingers curving almost tenderly around the sides. Carefully, Garrett pulled his head down until she felt his nose and mouth on her forehead. The contact lasted only an instant, but it was electrifying. The smooth touch of his lips and the warm rush of his breath drew up another rush of feeling, a warmth that seemed to radiate from her quick. She breathed in the scent of him, the scrubbed leather pungency of a clean and healthy male. Ransom drew back slowly.
"You could follow that with a knee to the groin," he said, if your skirts aren't too heavy or narrow.
Do you mean I should use my leg to... Her gaze flickered to his crotch.
Like this, he demonstrated with a subtle motion of his knee.
I think walking skirts would allow for that.
Then do it, Ransom said. It's the most devastating target on a man. The pain shoots all through your innards.
I've no doubt it would, Garrett mused. There's a nerve in the scrotum called the spermatic plexus that extends into the abdomen.
Noticing the way he averted his face, she said apologetically, Have I made you uncomfortable? I beg your pardon.
Ransom lifted his head to reveal eyes glinting with laughter.
Not at all. It's just that I've never heard a lady talk as you do.
As I told you, I'm not a lady.
Chapter 4 The lesson that followed could not have been more different from Garrett's sessions with Monsieur Beaujart or his prévôt, who emphasized discipline, silence, and perfect form. This, by contrast, seemed like a rough-and-tumble form of play. In fact, every minute of twisting, grappling, and shoving was so absorbing that Garrett lost all awareness of time passing. Although she wasn't used to having a man's hands on her, Ransom's touch was so careful and gentle that she quickly came to trust him. Patiently, he demonstrated various moves, and encouraged her to repeat them until he was satisfied that she'd learned them properly. He praised her efforts, calling her a warrior, an Amazon, and more than once he chuckled at her enthusiasm. As promised, he taught her how to throw a man to the floor by hooking a foot around his leg and using it as leverage to push him off balance. Every time he hit the ground, he rolled in a fluid motion and came to his feet again.
"Where did you learn to do that?" Garrett asked.
"After I left K Division, I was sent away for special training."
"Away to where?"
For some reason, Ransom seemed reluctant to answer.
"India."
"India? Good heavens, for how long?"
"A year and a half."
Seeing her interest, Ransom explained cautiously,
"I was instructed by an 80-year-old guru, who was as limber as a lad of 16. He taught a fighting system based on animal movements like the tiger or the snake."
"How perfectly fascinating."
Garrett would have liked to ask more, but he motioned for her to face away from him.
"This is what to do if someone seizes you in a bear hug."
He hesitated.
"I'll have to put my arms around you."
Garrett nodded and held trustingly still, as his arms enclosed her. His grip was firm but not crushing, taking enough of her weight that her heels nearly began to lift from the floor. His body was hot, almost steaming inside the fencing jacket. She was surrounded by the strength of him, breathing in the salt and heat of male exertion, while the motion of his breathing pressed against her rhythmically.
"Do bears actually hug like this?" she asked breathlessly.
"I don't know," Ransom said, his amused voice close to her ear. "I've never been close enough to want to find out. Now then, you want to keep me from picking you up and carrying you off. Shove your hips back and use all your weight to plant your feet hard on the ground."
He waited until she had complied. The movement had obliged him to lean over her, altering his centre of gravity.
"Good. Take a sidestep, and that will give you a clear path to deliver a hammer blow to the groin."
He watched as she knotted her fingers into a ball.
"Not like that. Has no one ever taught you to make a fist?"
"Never. Show me."
Releasing her, Ransom turned her to face him. He took her hand in both of his, moulding it to the proper shape.
"Curl your fingers and cross your thumb over them. Don't tuck it inside or you'll break it when you hit someone. And don't clench so tight that your little finger starts to collapse inward."
He tested the tension of her closed hand, running the pad of his thumb across her knuckles. The dark fans of his lashes lowered. She thought he would let go then, but instead, his fingertips slowly began to explore the miniature valleys between her fingers, the buffed surface of her nails, the soft flesh at the base of her thumb. Garrett's breath caught as he touched the tender inside of her wrist, where a pulse beat light and fast.
"Why were you named Garrett?"
she heard him ask. "My mother was convinced that I was going to be a boy. She wanted to name me after one of her brothers, who died while he was still young. But she didn't survive my birth. Above the objections of friends and relations, my father insisted on calling me Garrett anyway."
"I like it," Ransom murmured.
"It suits me," Garrett said. although I'm not certain my mother would have approved of giving a masculine name to a daughter. After a reflective pause, she surprised herself by saying impulsively, "Sometimes I imagine going back in time to stop the hemorrhage that killed her."
"Is that why you became a doctor?"
Garrett pondered the question with a slight frown. "I've never thought about it that way before. I suppose helping people could be my way of saving her over and over. But I would have found the study of medicine fascinating regardless. The human body is a remarkable machine." His fingers stroked over the back of her hand, as if he were smoothing out a tiny silk handkerchief. "Why did you enter into law enforcement?" she asked him.
"When I was a boy, I always liked watching the constables when they brought the prisoner van every morning. Big, strong chaps, in their blue uniforms and shiny black shoes. I liked the way they brought order to things."
"What made you want to be one of them?" Ransom drew the tip of his forefinger gently over each of her knuckles, a bit furtively, as if it were something he knew he shouldn't be doing.
"My father earned £5 a week. It was good pay, especially if we were allowed to live in a watch house on the prison grounds. But even so, there were times when we couldn't make the money stretch. When Mam worried that I'd not but potatoes and milk for weeks, or too many bills had gone unpaid, she would slip away to visit a married gentleman she had an arrangement with. Later, Da would see the new soles on my shoes, or a fresh stock of candles and coal in the house, and he would beat her without a word. Then he beat me for trying to stop him, and he wept while he did it. The next day, all three of us would carry on as usual, but I couldn't forget about it. I kept telling myself that some day I'd have the power to stop Da, or any man, from hurting Mam. To this day, when I see a woman being threatened or harmed, it's like setting flame to gunpowder." Seeming to realize he was still holding Garrett's hand, Ransom abruptly let go. "I was too young to understand what Mam had done with her gentleman friend, or why Da, who fair worshipped her, should have beaten her for it, or why Mam wouldn't let me speak against him. Any husband might be moved to thrash his wife," she said. "It was the nature of men. But she hoped I would be better than that."
He gave her a troubled, worn-around-the-edges look.
"I told her I would never strike a woman, and never have. I'd cut my arm off first."
"I believe you," Garrett said gently. "Your mother was mistaken. It's not men's nature to commit violence against women. It's a corruption of their nature."
"I like to think so," he muttered. "But I've seen too much evil to be sure."
"So have I," Garrett said simply. "Nevertheless, I know I'm right."
"I envy your certainty."
What a smile he had, like something that had just been unleashed. She'd never talked like this with a man in her life. The conversation was easy on the surface, but beneath, it reminded her a little of the feeling she'd had the day of her first classes at the Sorbonne. She'd been terrified and exhilarated by the world of mysteries about to be revealed.
"We'll have to end the lesson soon," Ransom said reluctantly. "I've gone over time."
"Have we?" she asked, bemused.
"It's been almost 2 hours. We'll practice the last move once more, and that will be the end of it."
"I'm sure there's much more for me to learn," Garrett said, facing away from him. "When shall we plan to meet next?" Ransom's arms slid around her from behind.
"I'm afraid I have obligations that will keep me busy for a while."
After a long pause, he said,
"After today, you won't see me again."
"For how long?"
"Ever."
Garrett blinked in surprise. She turned in the circle of his arms to face him. "But..." She was mortified to hear the plaintive note in her voice as she asked, "What about Tuesdays?"
"I can't follow you on Tuesdays any longer. Soon I'll have to go to ground for a while, maybe for good."
"Why? Are you planning to save England? Defeat an evil mastermind?"
"I can't tell you."
"Oh, twaddle. Anything you say will be shielded by doctor-patient confidentiality."
Ransom smiled slightly. "I'm not your patient."
"You could be some day," Garrett said darkly, "considering your occupation." His only response was to turn her around to face away from him. A bleak feeling crept through her as she complied. How could it be that she might never see him again? Did it really have something to do with his job? Perhaps that was a convenient excuse, and the truth was he had no interest in her.
Perhaps the attraction was only on her side. Garrett was appalled to feel a knot of disappointment forming in her throat.
"Remember to push against," Ransom began,
when the door opened unceremoniously. They both looked at the doorway, where Monsieur Beaujart stood glowering.
"I need to use this room for a scheduled lesson," the fencing master announced.
His eyes narrowed at the sight of them, locked together.
"Is this the way you're teaching Dr. Gibson to fight for her life?"
he asked sarcastically. Garrett replied in a matter-of-fact tone. "This is a defensive manoeuvre, monsieur. I'm about to deliver an incapacitating strike to the groin." The fencing master regarded them both with a stony gaze.
"Good,"
he grunted, and the door closed smartly behind him. Before Garrett could continue, she felt Ransom press his face against the back of her shoulder, chuckling like a mischievous boy in church.
"Now you've done it," he said. "Beaujart won't be satisfied unless I limp out of here in agony."
A reluctant grin crossed her lips. "For the sake of England, I'll have mercy on you." As he had taught her before, she pushed her hips back and leaned forward. The fit between them was close and compact, their bodies aligning like puzzle pieces. Her mind went blank as she felt the pure, visceral pleasure of his weight and warmth over her. His arms tightened, and there was a quiet catch in his throat, as if he weren't certain whether to breathe in or out. In the next moment, he had released her and collapsed to a seated position in an uncharacteristically clumsy movement. His long arms curled around his bent legs, and he rested his forehead on his knees. Alarmed, Garrett lowered to her knees beside him. "What's wrong?"
"Strained muscle,"
he said, in a muffled voice. But it appeared more serious than that. His colour was high, and he seemed on the verge of hyperventilating. "Do you feel dizzy?" Garrett asked in worry. "Light-headed?" She laid her palm against the side of his face, testing his temperature, and he jerked away from her touch. "Let me take your pulse," she said, reaching for him again. Ransom snatched her wrist, his gaze meeting hers in a blaze of unearthly blue.
"Don't touch me, or I'll..."
Breaking off, he rolled away and rose to his feet in a single easy motion. He went to the opposite wall and braced his hands against it, his head lowered. Garrett stared after him, her jaw sagging. Before he turned his back, she'd caught a glimpse of something that was most definitely not a strained muscle. It was a different kind of problem altogether. As the fencing trousers displayed so flagrantly, he was aroused, prodigiously, impressively so. Colour invaded Garrett's face until her cheeks felt scorched. At a complete loss for what to do, she remained kneeling on the floor. All her skin felt tight and seared, and she was filled with a sense of, well, she didn't quite know what it was. Not embarrassment, although her complexion had turned beetroot red. Not pleasure, exactly, although her nerves thrummed with giddiness. She had never been a woman whose presence excited the male ardour, partly because she'd never cultivated the skills of flirtation and feminine charm, also because when she first met a man, she was usually jabbing him with suture needles, or injection syringes. "Would it help if I fetch a glass of cold water?" she dared to ask in a timid voice that didn't even sound like hers. Ransom replied with his forehead leaning against the wall.
"Not unless you pour it down my trousers."
A strangled laugh was wrenched from her throat. He turned to give her a sideways glance then, a flash of hot, infinite blue, conveying the force of a desire as immolating as a lightning bolt. Even with Garrett's reams of knowledge about the workings of the human body, she could only begin to comprehend all that was contained in that blistering look. His voice was dry and fractured with self-mockery.
"As you said, Doctor, there is a part of every man that's untamed and unsubdued."
Chapter 5. "What did he say after that?" Lady Helen Winterbourne whispered across the tea table, her blue-grey eyes as round as silver florins. "What did you say?"
"I can't remember," Garrett confessed, amazed to feel her face heating up even now, 3 days later. "My mind turned to mush. It was so unexpected."
"Had you never seen a man in that state?" Helen asked delicately.
Garrett gave her a sardonic glance. I'm a former nurse as well as a physician. I dare say I've seen as many erections as a brothel, madam, she frowned, but never one that had anything to do with me. Helen hastily crammed a linen napkin against her lips, muffling a laugh. As was their weekly habit, they had met for lunch at the renowned tea room of Winterbourne's department store. The tea room was a serene refuge from the heat and bustle of the day. A tall-ceilinged, airy room decorated with frothy green potted palms, the walls lined with mosaics of blue, white, and gold tiles. The main floor was crowded with ladies and gentlemen clustered at the round tables. Each corner of the tea room featured an inset alcove, where the table was set back enough to allow for private conversation. As Winterbourne's wife, of course, Helen was always seated at one of the alcove tables. Garrett had been friends with Helen ever since she'd been hired as one of Winterbourne's staff physicians. She had quickly discovered that not only was Helen kind, sensible, and loyal, she could also be trusted to keep her mouth shut. They had a great deal in common, including a commitment to helping those less fortunate. In the past year, Helen had become the patroness of several charities benefiting women and children, and worked actively for reform causes. Recently, Helen had insisted that Garrett start attending some of the fundraising dinners and private concerts she and Winterbourne hosted. "You can't work all the time," Helen had told her in a gentle but resolute tone. "Now and then you must spend an evening in the society of others." "I'm in the company of people every day," Garrett had protested. "At the clinic, yes. But I'm referring to a social evening when you put on a nice dress and make small talk. And perhaps even dance."
"You're not going to try matchmaking for me, are you?" Garrett had asked suspiciously. Helen had given her a chiding smile.
"There's no harm in making the acquaintance of a few unmarried gentlemen. You're not opposed to the idea of marriage, are you?"
"Not exactly. But I've never been able to see how my life could accommodate a husband. He couldn't be the sort of man who insisted that the household revolve around his needs. Nor could he expect me to be a traditional wife. He would have to be as unconventional as I am. I'm not sure such a man exists."
Garrett had shrugged and smiled wryly. "I don't mind being on the shelf, as they say. It happens to be a very interesting shelf."
"If he's out there," Helen had told her, "you certainly won't find him by staying at home. You're coming to our next dinner, and that means we must have a new evening dress made up for you."
"I have an evening dress," Garrett had said, thinking of her sapphire brocade, which was a few years old, but had worn like iron.
"I've seen it, and it's very
nice," Helen said, damning the garment with faint praise.
"However, you need something more festive and lower cut. No women our age wear high-necked evening gowns. Those are only for young girls or dowagers."
Acknowledging that fashion was not necessarily her forte, Garrett had agreed to visit the store's in-house dressmaker, Mrs. Allenby, after tea with Helen today. Her thoughts were drawn back to the present, as Helen regained her composure and murmured,
"Poor Mr. Ransom. It must be dreadfully embarrassing for a man to be caught in that state."
"No doubt it was," Garrett said, nibbling at a miniature sandwich made of a nasturtium leaf and cream cheese, pressed between two thin slices of French roll. But Ransom hadn't seemed embarrassed. A ticklish sensation wove through her, as she recalled the look he'd given her. A starving tiger look, all desire and instinct, as if it had taken every last flicker of his will to hold himself back from her.
"How did the lesson end?" Helen asked.
"After we had changed into our street clothes, Ransom met me outside and hailed a hansom cab for me. Before I climbed into the seat, he thanked me for the time we'd spent together, and said he regretted very much that we couldn't meet again. I can't remember what I said, only that I extended my hand for him to shake, and he..."
"He what?"
Fractious colour rose in her face.
"He kissed it," Garrett managed to say, remembering the sight of his dark head bent over her gloved hand. "It was the last thing I expected. That big blue-eyed ruffian doing something so gentlemanly. Especially after we'd spent the past 2 hours grappling and slamming each other all around the fencing room." A gesture so tender, it had left her stunned and speechless. Even now, the thought of it sent flutters of pleasure and heat through her. It was madness. With all the patients she had examined and operated on, all the people she had held and comforted, nothing had ever felt so intimate as the pressure of his lips on her glove. I haven't been able to stop thinking about it, Garrett continued. I can't keep from wondering what it would be like if... She couldn't say the rest of it aloud. She began to fiddle with a tiny sorbet spoon. I want to see him again, she confessed. Oh, dear, she heard Helen murmur. I don't know how to reach him. Garrett slid her a guarded glance. But your husband does. Helen looked uncomfortable. If Mr. Ransom says he can't meet with you, I think you should respect his decision. He could visit me on the sly, if he wished, Garrett pointed out irritably. The man skulks around London like a stray cat. If he did meet you in secret, where would it lead? Or, rather, where would you want it to lead? I'm not sure. Garrett set aside the sorbet spoon, picked up a fork, and stabbed a strawberry. She used a knife to mince it into minuscule bits. Obviously Ransom is not an appropriate companion for me. I should put him and his private parts completely out of my mind. That might be for the best, Helen said cautiously. Except that I can't. Setting down the utensils, Garrett muttered, I've never been ruled by unwanted thoughts or feelings. I've always been able to put them away as if they were folded linens in a drawer. What's the matter with me? Helen slid a cool, pale hand over her clenched fist and gave it a comforting squeeze. You've been all work and no play for much too long. And then one night, a mysterious and handsome man appears out of the shadows, fending off attackers on your behalf. That part was annoying, Garrett interrupted. I was doing quite well at being my own hero until he jumped in. Helen's lips curved. Still. It must have been a little flattering. It was, Garrett grumbled, taking refuge in examining the plate of tea sandwiches. She selected one filled with a translucent slice of pickled artichoke heart and a sliver of boiled egg. In fact, it was ridiculous how dashing he was, all brass and brawn. Only to you would I admit that when I heard his Irish brogue, I nearly began batting my eyelashes and simpering, like the ingenue from some second-rate playhouse. Helen laughed gently. There's something charming about a man with an accent, isn't there? I know it's considered a defect, even more so if the accent is Welsh. But to me, there's poetry in it. Nowadays, having an Irish brogue is the surest way to have a door slammed in one's face, said Garrett darkly, which is no doubt why Mr. Ransom conceals it. During the past 10 years, the political unrest of those who believed in Ireland's right to govern itself had fueled an atmosphere of growing intolerance. Rumours of conspiracies were everywhere, and the people found it difficult to separate prejudice from reason, especially now, after a recent spate of terrorist activities, including a recently foiled attempt on the Prince of Wales's life. "The man is neither respectable nor gainfully employed," Garrett continued. He's also sneaky, violent, and apparently as randy as a stoat. I can't possibly be attracted to him.
Attraction isn't something one chooses, Helen mused. It's a kind of magnetism, an irresistible force.
I will not be held hostage by invisible forces. Helen regarded her with a sympathetic smile.
This reminds me a bit of what you told me after Pandora was injured in the street attack. You said she had received a shock to her entire nervous system. I think Mr. Ransom has been a shock to your system. Among other things, I think he's made you realize that you might be a bit lonely.
Garrett, who had always taken pride in her self-sufficiency, shot her an indignant glance. Impossible! How could I be lonely when I have you and my other friends, my father, Dr. Havelock, my patients?
I meant a different kind of loneliness.
Garrett scowled. I'm not some dewy-eyed girl with a head full of spun sugar. I should hope I'm more high-minded than that.
Even a high-minded woman can appreciate a fine pair of... what did you call them? Quadriceps?
One could hardly miss the sly teasing in Helen's demure tone. Taking refuge in dignified silence, Garrett drained another cup of tea while a waitress came to the table with little glass cups of lemon sorbet. Helen waited until after the waitress had departed before saying,
"Hear me out before you refuse. I want very much to introduce you to my cousin, West. He'll be in town for a fortnight. You didn't meet him the last time he was here to see Pandora. We'll all have dinner at Ravenel House one evening.
No, I beg you, Helen, do not put me or your cousin through such pointless torture.
West is very handsome, Helen persisted. Dark-haired, blue-eyed, and charming. I'm positive you'll like each other. After a few minutes in his company, you'll forget all about Mr. Ransom.
Even in the unlikely event that Mr. Ravenel and I formed an attachment, it would never work. I can't live in the country.
Garrett tried a spoonful of sorbet, letting the tart, sugary frost dissolve into a cold flood on her tongue.
Among other things, I'm afraid of cows.
Because of their size? Helen asked, sympathetically.
No, it's the way they stare, as if they're plotting something. Helen chuckled.
I promise, when you come to visit Eversby Priory some day, all scheming cows will be kept out of sight. And as far as living in the country is concerned, West may be willing to move back to London. He's a man of many interests and talents. Oh, do say you'll at least meet him.
I'll consider it, Garrett said, reluctantly.
Thank you. That sets my mind at ease.
A new serious note entered Helen's voice.
Because I fear there's a very good reason Mr. Ransom has decided to stay away from you.
Garrett looked at her alertly.
What is it?
Helen frowned, seeming to debate something within her mind before continuing.
I know some information about Mr. Ransom. I'm not at liberty to relay all of it, but there's something you should be made aware of.
Garrett waited with forced patience while Helen glanced around to make certain no one was approaching the alcove.
It has to do with that incident at the Guildhall last month, Helen said softly. You'll recall that Pandora and Lord St. Vincent attended the reception.
Garrett nodded, having heard from Pandora herself about how a loose plank had led to the discovery that bombs had been laid beneath the floor. Within a few minutes, the panicked crowd had rapidly fled the building. Fortunately, the explosive devices had been dismantled before they could be detonated. No arrests had been made in connection to the plot, but it had been blamed on a small group of radical Irish nationalists.
One of the reception guests passed away that night, Helen continued. An under-secretary from the Home Office, Mr. Nash Prescott.
Garrett nodded.
As I recall from the account in the Times, he had a weak heart. In the midst of all the alarm and confusion, he experienced a fatal cardiac seizure.
That's the official story, Helen said. But Lord St. Vincent told Mr. Winterbourne privately that Mr. Prescott had known about the bomb plot in advance, and it was none other than Mr. Ransom who found Mr. Prescott's body not far from the Guildhall grounds, she paused, after having given chase to him.
Ransom chased him from the reception? Garrett looked at her sharply. Believe me, no one in the middle of a cardiac event would be running anywhere.
Exactly. Helen hesitated. No one knows for certain what caused Mr. Prescott's death. However, it's possible that Mr. Ransom...
Her voice trailed away, the suspicion too terrible to be uttered out loud.
Why would he do that?
Garrett asked over a long moment.
Do you think he may be on the side of the conspirators?
No one knows what side he's on. But he's not a man you should have anything to do with.
Helen gave her a worried, affectionate look.
My husband has a saying about risk-taking. God is good, but never dance in a small boat.
The cloud of gloom that Helen's information had cast over Garrett was not helped the following day, when her father waved the latest copy of the Police Gazette beneath her nose, asking pointedly,
"What do you make of this, daughter?"
Frowning, Garrett took the newspaper from him, her gaze skimming rapidly over the page.
On Wednesday night, the King's Cross Court holding jail was broken and entered by an unseen intruder, who proceeded to attack a cell of three prisoners. The victims are soldiers in Her Majesty's 9th Regiment of Foot, confined on charges of assault against a lady whose person has not been publicly identified. The intruder escaped before he could be apprehended. All three soldiers will remain in custody without chance of bail until their future appearance at the Assizes. Any person giving information to W. Cross, Chief Constable, leading to the apprehension of the unknown offender, shall, on his conviction, receive £10 reward. Struggling to conceal the signs of inner chaos,
Garrett handed the paper back. Dear God, how could Ransom have attacked 3 men in custody?
There's no proof that Mr. Ransom did it, she said crisply. Only Jenkins' men would be capable of going in and out of a heavily guarded court jail without being caught.
Garrett brought herself to meet her father's gaze with difficulty. After recent weight loss, the skin of his formerly full-cheeked face now hung slightly loose, and there were deep pockets under his eyes, and he looked so kind and tired that it made her throat tighten. Mr. Ransom can't tolerate any manner of violence against women, she said.
That's no excuse, of course. You made light of what happened that night, her father said soberly. You said those soldiers only insulted you. But it was worse than that, wasn't it?
Yes, Papa.
Then those jackals deserved whatever Ransom did to them. He may be a cold-blooded cutthroat, his soul is bound for hell, but he has my thanks. I'd thrash the bastards myself if I could.
I wouldn't approve of you doing any more than I would him, Garrett informed him, folding her arms. A vigilante is no better than a thug.
Is that what you're going to tell him?
A wry smile edged her lips. Are you trying to trick me into some kind of admission, Papa? I have no intention of seeing Mr. Ransom again. Her father snorted and lifted the Gazette to continue reading. His voice floated out from behind the rustling pages.
Just because you can look a man in the eyes when you lie doesn't mean you've fooled him.
The next few days were nothing but annoyance and drudgery. Garrett delivered the baby of a department manager's wife, set a broken collarbone, and performed minor surgery to remove a benign tumour, and all of it felt perfunctory. Not even an interesting case of rheumatic effusions of the knee joints could cheer her up. For the first time in Garrett's life, her enthusiasm for work, the thing that had always filled her with purpose and satisfaction, had inexplicably disappeared. So far, she had managed to avoid dinner with Ravenel's, pleading exhaustion after having stayed up 24 hours with the patient in labour, but she knew another invitation would soon be forthcoming, and she would have to accept. On Tuesday afternoon, as Garrett loaded her bag with supplies for her Tuesday visit to the workhouse, her partner at the clinic approached her. Although Dr. William Havelock had made no secret of his objections when Winterbourne had hired a female physician, he had soon become a mentor and a trusted friend. The middle-aged man, with his distinctive shock of white hair and large leonine head, was everyone's idea of what a doctor should look like. He was a man of remarkable skills and judgment, and Garrett had learned a great deal from him. To his credit, Havelock, despite his gruff manner, was a fair and open-minded man. After some initial resistance, he came to regard Garrett's surgical training at the Sorbonne with interest rather than suspicion, and had soon adopted the antiseptic method she had learned from Sir Joseph Lister. As a result, the patients at the Cork Street Clinic experienced a substantially higher and faster rate of post-operative healing than average. Garrett looked up as Dr. Havelock came to the doorway of the supply room with 2 small glass laboratory beakers containing pale gold liquid.
"I've bought you a restorative tonic," he said,
coming forward to hand her one of the beakers. Lifting her brows, Garrett took the beaker and sniffed the contents cautiously. A reluctant smile crossed her lips. "Whiskey?"
"Dewar's whiskey."
Regarding her with a shrewd but kindly gaze, he raised his beaker in a toast.
"Happy birthday!"
Garrett's eyes turned round with amazement. Her father hadn't remembered, and she'd never told the date to anyone. "How did you know?"
"The date was on your employment application. Since my wife keeps the files, she knows everyone's birthday and never forgets a one."
They clinked glasses and drank. The whiskey was strong but very smooth, flavours of malt, honey and cut hay lingering on Garrett's tongue. Closing her eyes briefly, she felt the soft fire travel down her esophagus. "Excellent," she pronounced and smiled at him, "and much appreciated. Thank you, Dr. Havelock."
"One more toast. Nenque semper our contented Apollo."
They drank again. "What does that mean?" Garrett asked.
"Not even Apollo keeps his bow drawn all the time."
Havelock regarded her kindly.
"You've been in a sour mood of late. I don't know the specifics of your problem, but I have an idea as to the general cause.
You're a dedicated physician who has shouldered many responsibilities in such a capable manner that all of us, including you, tend to forget something. You're still a young woman.
At 28, Garrett asked bleakly, and took another swallow. Still holding the beaker, she reached for a box of adhesive plasters and dropped it into her bag.
A mere babe in the woods, he said. And like all young people, you tend to rebel against a harsh taskmaster.
I've never thought of you that way, Garrett protested. Havelock's mouth twisted.
I'm not the harsh taskmaster, Doctor, you are. The fact is, recreation is a natural necessity. Your work habits have turned you into a wet blanket, and you will continue being a wet blanket until you find some leisure activity outside of this clinic.
Garrett frowned. I have no outside interests.
If you were a man, I'd advise you to spend a night at the best bawdy house you could afford. However, I've no idea what to recommend to a woman in your position. Look at a list of hobbies and pick one. Have an affair. Go on holiday to a place you've never been before.
Garrett coughed on a sip of whiskey and regarded him with wide, watering eyes.
Did you just advise me to have an affair?
She asked hoarsely. Havelock let out a rusty chuckle.
I've surprised you, haven't I? Not as stodgy as you thought. There's no need to stare at me like a dyspeptic nun. As a physician, you're well aware that the sexual act can be separated from procreation without descending to prostitution. You work like a man, you're paid like one, and you might as well take your pleasures like one, so long as you're discreet about it.
Garrett had to drain the last of her whiskey before she could reply. Moral considerations aside, the risk isn't worth it. Being caught in an affair wouldn't ruin a man's career, but it would ruin mine.
Then find someone to marry. Love is not something to be missed, Dr. Gibson. Why do you think I, a comfortable widower, made a fool of myself over Mrs. Fernsby until she finally consented to be my wife?
Convenience? She guessed.
Good God, no. There's nothing convenient about joining your life to another person's. Marriage is a sack race. You may find a way to hop together toward the finish line, but you would still reach it more easily without the sack.
Then why do it at all?
Our existence, even our intellect, hangs upon love. Without it, we would be no more than stock and stones.
Inwardly astonished by such a sentimental speech coming from Havelock, of all men, Garrett protested, It's no simple task to find someone to love. You make it sound as easy as shopping for a good melon.
Obviously, you've done neither of those things. Finding someone to love is considerably easier than finding a good melon.
Garrett smiled wryly. I'm sure your advice is well-intentioned, but I have no use for melons or grand love affairs. She handed the empty beaker to him. However, I'll try to come up with a hobby.
That's a start.
Havelock went to the doorway and paused to glance over his shoulder.
You're very good at listening to other people, my young friend, but you're not nearly as good at listening to yourself.
Night was falling by the time Garrett had finished her rounds at the Clerkenwell Workhouse Infirmary. Fatigued and hungry, she removed her white apron and donned her dark brown walking jacket, trimmed with silk braid, and cinched with a thin leather belt around the waist. After gathering up her cane and doctor's bag, she left the workhouse and stopped just beyond the iron gate, on a front walkway mottled with light and shadow. In the weary hush of the summer evening, she started on the walk back to the main road. The wail of a distant train rode on the dull thunder of churning rods, hissing boilers, and metal wheels. Her steps faltered as she realized that she was reluctant to return home. There was no compelling reason to be there. Her father was playing his weekly game of draw poker with his friends and wouldn't miss her. But she couldn't think of where else to go. The clinic and the department store were closed, and it certainly would not do to appear uninvited at someone else's home. Her stomach growled beneath the confines of her light corset. She realized she'd forgotten to eat lunch. One of the cardinal rules of navigating through the dangerous areas of the city was to appear confident. And here she was, pausing at a street corner, her feet as heavy as lead. What was she doing? What was this terrible feeling inside? Sadness wrapped around yearning.
a hollow feeling that no blasted hobby or holiday was ever going to fix. Perhaps she should go visit Helen unannounced. Manners be damned. Helen would listen to her worries and know what to say. But no, that would only lead to more urging to meet Weston Ravenel, a substitute for the man she truly wanted to see, an amoral, oversexed government assassin with a dimple in one cheek. Garrett's mind sifted through remnants of conversations she'd had during the past week. No one knows what side he's on, but he's not a man you should have anything to do with.
Ransom is a cold-blooded cutthroat, his soul is bound for hell.
If he did meet you in secret, where would it lead? And Ransom's low voice. I see no fault in you. As Garrett stood there, trapped in that mysterious ache of a mood, she could hear a couple quarrelling on a nearby street, the bray of a donkey, the cries of a watercress seller as he rolled his handcart along the pavement. The accumulated hum of city noise filled each passing second as London eased from the tumult of the day to the seething excitement of a warm summer night. It was a mean, big-bellied, prosperous city, shod in brick and iron, wearing a thick overcoat of factory smoke, carrying a million secrets in its pockets. Garrett loved it, all of it, from the Dome of St. Paul's down to the lowest sewer rat. London, her friends and her work had always been enough for her. Until now. I wish, she whispered, and bit her lip. Where was Ransom at this moment? Maybe loving the sewer rat was taking it a bit far. I wish, a phrase she had never used. If she closed her eyes, which she was not idiotic enough to do in a parish containing three prisons, she felt as if she might actually be able to see him, like an image trapped in a fortune-teller's crystal ball. Garrett was bemused to discover the silver police whistle was in her hand. Without even being aware of it, she had fished the whistle from her jacket pocket. The pad of her thumb rubbed across the gleaming surface. Obeying a lunatic impulse, she raised the whistle to her lips and gave an abbreviated blow, not enough to produce a shrill alarm that would alert a constable, just a little chirp. She closed her eyes and counted to three, waiting and listening for an approaching footstep. Oh, I wish, I wish. Nothing. Her lashes lifted. No one was there. It was time to go home. Morosely, she tucked the whistle back into her pocket, unhooked the cane from her left arm, and turned to leave. A smothered exclamation was torn from her as she walked into a wall, the leather bag dropping from her hand.
Suffering saviour!
Not a wall, a man. Her face was mashed against the centre of a broad chest. Before her mind fully comprehended what had happened, her body had already recognised the feel of tough, heavy muscle, the big hands gripping her securely, the clean, masculine scent that was nicer than anything in the world. Dark blue eyes took swift and thorough inventory of her, assuring himself of her well-being. Ransom. He'd been following her after all. A shaken breath of laughter escaped her. As she looked up into his hard face, exhilaration flooded through her, as if it had been injected directly into an artery. She was shocked at how good it felt to be with him. Her soul was leaping.
"That whistle is only for when you need help," Ransom said in a low voice.
A scowl darkened his face, but his fingertips flexed slightly as if he longed to fondle and caress the shape of her. Garrett couldn't help smiling up at him. "I do need help," she replied, striving for a normal tone. "I'm hungry." A hint of raw emotion stirred beneath his controlled surface.
"Akushla," he said in a rough whisper, "don't do this."
"It's my birthday," she told him. His hot gaze turned her inside out.
"Is it?"
She nodded, trying to look forlorn. "I'm alone and hungry, and it's my birthday." Ransom uttered a curse as soft as a vesper prayer, and lifted his hand to her face, gently cupping her jaw. The touch of his fingers was so pleasant that she felt a change come over all her skin. After surveying her for a burning moment, he shook his head grimly, as if marvelling at a particularly unfortunate turn of fate. He bent to pick up her bag.
"Come," he said. And she went with him, neither asking nor caring where they were going. Chapter 6